The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to all of you. I'm Catherine Colbert, and I'm thrilled that you have joined us tonight for what promises to be an illuminating discussion about how all of us can safeguard our most fundamental freedoms. You know, we are in the midst of an unprecedented attacks that undermine our democracy and individual freedoms. Everything from the January 6th insurrection to draconian limits on voting rights, from book bans to laws that penalize teachers for helping youth. These disturbing actions, including the most recent draft opinion we've all seen from the U.S. Supreme Court that overrules Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, all of these starkly highlight the fragility of our civil rights and civil liberties. There's perhaps no one better able to comment on these developments and provide a roadmap for action than our guest tonight, Attorney General Eric Holder, Jr., who'll be discussing his new book, Our Unfinished March, The Violent Past and Imperiled Future of the Vote, A History in a Crisis and a Plan, that he co-authored with Sam Kopelman. Tracy Matisak, an award-winning broadcaster and journalist, will join General Holder for this great conversation. As most of you know, General Holder made history in 2009 when President Barack Obama appointed him Attorney General, the first African-American to hold that position. He served for over 6 years, from February 2009 to April 2015, the third longest serving attorney general in U.S. history. During his tenure, he championed hallmark legislation on voting rights, immigration law, national security, and same-sex marriage, and his continuing pursuits for civil rights have continued with his post-White House career, serving now as the chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee and using his unique expertise as a leading advocate for voting rights. Please join me in welcoming Eric Holder and Tracy Matisak.
Well, Kitty, thank you so much. Thanks to all of you for being with us this evening. And by the way, before we get started, I just want to mention that if you have not seen Catherine Colbert's TED Talk about Roe v. Wade, you'll want to check that out on YouTube after this interview, of course, but well worth watching. Well, thanks again to all of you for being with us. As always, we have budgeted some time at the end of our conversation for your questions. So you'll just want to click on the icon, the Q&A icon at the bottom of your screen. You can enter your question there and we'll get through as many as we can before we have to say goodbye. But that said, Attorney General Eric Holder, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to be here. I hoped that we'd have an opportunity to meet in person, but I think we're doing the responsible thing. I'm excited to talk about my new book with you, Our Unfinished March, and with all of the people in the audience, and talk about how we can go about, the fight to save our democracy. I don't think that Kitty was exaggerating the nature of the depth of the crisis that we are in. Our country has achieved inconceivable progress over the life of the nation, and in particular over the last few decades. But there is still an awful lot of work that we still have to do. But I think we're capable of doing that work. So I'm looking forward to this this conversation. And because I'm no longer a part of an administration, I can say whatever the heck I want to say. So, please send us your questions and I'll answer them as best I can.
Sounds great. Well, before we dive into the book, I'd like to start with a little bit of perspective. So as we head into the midterm elections, what is the state of voting rights in the country? In other words, can you give us a sense of the size of the effort to make voting more difficult?
Yeah, I'd say, Tracy, it's a mixed bag. In certain states, things have gotten markedly better. I think of Virginia, Michigan. Other states, Texas, by contrast, Georgia, Florida looks like it's going in a negative way. Other states are going in other directions. There's been a really sustained effort. You've heard about 400 bills introduced, in a variety of states to make it more difficult for people to vote. I guess about 30, 40 of those bills have actually been passed. Everything from photo ID to not giving people food and water as they're waiting in line. That one is from Georgia. So it's a real mixed bag. And what we are not seeing is what I think we ought to see is some kind of federal intervention to try to lay out some basic ground rules so that we have more coherence with regard to what our voting system looks like.
Yeah. And I know that you expressed frustration around not having that federal guidance, and I want to come to that in a little bit. But I was interested that before you even get to chapter one in the book, you felt compelled to make a 4-point case for democracy. And I wonder what it says about the state of our nation that you felt it necessary to make the case for democracy at the front end of the book.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because the book was written without that first part, that first introduction, that first defense of democracy. And then as Sam and I were talking about it and realized kind of where the country was going, the attacks that were being made, Senator Mike Lee said that, we're not a democracy, and kind of said all the negative things that flow from democracy. And other people said, well, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. A bunch of code ways in which you say that people ultimately should not be the ones who decide the fate of the nation. We thought it made a great deal of sense to just kind of make the case for democracy. I mean, look, before we even get into what's going on in the United States and the history of the United States, the present situation that we face, what our proposals are for how we get out of this precarious situation. And we said, let's talk about why democracy is a good thing. And I thought one of the interesting things is that there has never been a pandemic. There's never been widespread hunger in a country that has had a functioning democracy. Churchill famously said, democracy has got all kinds of problems, but it's the best of a bunch of worst choices. And then we go through why exactly you want to have a democracy and why that's consistent with our founding ideals. Imperfect though we were at the beginning, the words that have guided us for over, 250 years at this point, are really all about allowing the people to decide the direction of the country.
Yeah. And then you write that since, in the earliest days of our history, the fact is that democracy has not been the rule, it's been the exception. And I think for many people that may on its face sound counterintuitive, but it's true. Explain.
Yeah, if you look at that first presidential election, only 6% of the adults in this country who now we would say have the ability to vote, only 6% of the people had the ability to cast a ballot for George Washington. Because if you were a white man and did not have property, you couldn't vote. If you were a woman, you couldn't vote. African-Americans who were enslaved obviously could not vote. Native Americans could not vote. So at the inception, we were not a true democracy. It is through time and through effort that we have become a more inclusive society and brought more people into the voting process.
And you write about how eventually white men who were not property owners and didn't meet a certain financial threshold did eventually get the right to vote, but at least in one case, it involved an insurrection.
Yeah, a guy named Thomas Dorr in Rhode Island said, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. Why should people be denied the right to vote men? Why should men be denied the right? Well, why should white men be denied the right to vote simply because they don't own property? And he fomented a rebellion in Rhode Island. Now, I have a number of proposals that we make. Fomenting rebellion is not one of them, but he nevertheless did that. Put in place a constitution that empowered or allowed white men who did not own property the ability to vote. was ultimately, you know, captured, jailed, and died a broken man. It's interesting, Rhode Island ultimately went back and now recognizes him as a legitimate governor of the state of Rhode Island. But he paid a substantial price for the belief that he had, and this is in the 1840s or so. So this is, you know, this is sometime after independence, where you still had white men without property in certain places not being able to vote. You know, Benjamin Franklin frankly said, all right, so if it's all about property, so if a man can vote today because he owns a jackass, what happens if the jackass dies between this election and the next one? Where is the right to vote really in existence? Is it in the jackass or in the man? And it is kind of an illogical thing. But as we, you know, as I say in the book, there has been this constant struggle in America about who gets to speak, whose voices are heard, who gets to direct the you know, the path of the nation. And that has been a constant push and pull from the time that we declared our independence.
So, and that struggle comes up in the next chapter, which is called A Moment in the Sun, How Black Men Won the Vote and White Men Stole It. And you write about how, you know, in the late 1860s that we had the 14th and 15th Amendments that provided equal citizenship, due process, the right to vote, at least for Black men. And then you say the Congress even passed a series of enforcement acts that were designed to make sure that the rights that were granted in those amendments were not taken away. And yet, in fact, they ultimately were taken away. What happened there?
Yeah, you know, we had, when I was a high school student, I was taught that that Reconstruction, that period after the Civil War in the South, was a failure. That, you know, there was this view that the attempts at democracy or the freeing of enslaved people did not result in much of any progress. Famously, you know, the D.W. Griffith movie, Birth of a Nation, shows, you know, newly freed people serving in positions of power and doing all kinds of crazy things on, you know, on the floor of legislatures, doing terrible things to women. And, you know, and that movie was played in the White House by, you know, Woodrow Wilson, then president of the United States. So that was kind of the view of what Reconstruction was like. And in fact, upon closer examination and led by, among others, a guy named Eric Foner, my history professor at Columbia, he looked and said, you know what, actually, Reconstruction was a greater success than people give it credit for. That, in fact, we had the beginnings there of a multiracial democracy where newly freed people had the ability to express themselves, elected substantial numbers of people of color to state positions, federal positions, senators, congressmen. And also, as a result of that, you started the beginnings of a free education system so that poor whites also had the ability, in addition to newly freed people, had the ability to have their children, you know, be educated. And so that period, that short, brief period of enlightenment, of multiracial progress, was wiped out when the status quo that lost the Civil War decided that it wanted to reassert itself. And it did so by forming organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and suppressing through violence, through intimidation, but through violence, suppressing the desires of people for to have and enjoy the rights that they were entitled to as citizens. At first, the federal government sent troops in to make sure that that did not happen. There's the Tilden-Hayes Compromise, get into that. But I mean, and ultimately, the federal government pulls out of the South, and white supremacy reasserts itself. And that brief period of successful multiracial democracy was extinguished.
Yeah. In that same chapter, you write, and I'm quoting here, our country moves forward and backward. We grant rights and then take them away. If you don't hold on to the progress you've made, if you don't remain vigilant in defending it, it will be reversed, which, of course, made me think not only of the 2013 Supreme Court decision that essentially took the heart out of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but also, of course, the current threat to Roe versus Wade. And I wonder if you see linkage there.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that, you know, there's really nothing new in the world at this point. And we are going through a very difficult time now. And we're seeing reversals in terms of, let's look at that, you know, that draft opinion coming out of the Supreme Court. This is something that was, it's going to be a reversal of the right to abortion that was 49 years old, that people have relied on in guiding their lives over the course of, you know, four decades, almost five decades. And now we're seeing that taken away. Now, this is the first time we've seen a constitutional right actually get taken away from the American people. But it is consistent with the way in which there have been gains like Reconstruction and then the destruction of that, gains after the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act and the flowering again of Black political power that was, if not destroyed, but certainly capped in substantial ways by the, or attempts to cap it after the 2013 Shelby County decision and all of the state statutes that were passed immediately after that, I think, very poor Supreme Court decision. I think, you know, as we talk about in the book, I think that the election of the first Black president was something that we could certainly hail and be proud of. I never thought that we were in a post-racial society, as some thought, but I did not expect necessarily the backlash that, you know, that we saw, and that in some ways I think that we are still experiencing. You know, there is a concern on, a lot of this is just about power. You know, who has power, who exercises power, how do you use that power? I think many see that this is a changing America. You know, and Barack Obama's election was a reflection of that. Our demographics are changing. I think our ideology is changing. And that was frightening to a lot of people. And that really brought into the political system a lot of these a lot of these anti-progress measures that we are now dealing with.
So you mentioned the Shelby County versus Holder case in 2013 that we also talked about just a moment ago. And as the holder in that case, we know that it had to do essentially with preclearance. Can you explain what that is and what the Supreme Court's decision did to the Voting Rights Act?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the deal, Tracy. Let's agree to just call it the Shelby County case. I don't want my name associated with Shelby County versus Holder. You know, I kid about that in some ways, but I almost like don't want people to know that I had anything to do with that case, even if I was trying to defend what I thought were good principles. But the Shelby County case, you know, Voting Rights Act had been reauthorized by Congress. By almost unanimous margins in both the House and in the Senate, had been signed by President George W. Bush, a Republican president. And the Congress had taken thousands of pages of testimony, looked at thousands of documents, and really made the case for why the continuation of the Voting Rights Act was necessary, that there was still indications of problems, discrimination in our electoral system. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, said, well, you know what? The coverage formula, I won't make this too complicated, but the coverage formula in the act is out of date and that it needs to be modernized. And as a result of that, it had the impact of taking away the Justice Department's power to pre-clear, the pre-clearance power that the Justice Department had. Now, pre-clearance simply meant that in the covered states, when they wanted to make a change, and those were generally the states in the old Confederacy, but also parts of New York State were under the Voting Rights Act of 1965. When you wanted to make a change in one of the covered jurisdictions, perhaps close polling stations, move polling stations, change voting dates, you had to get that pre-cleared by the Justice Department. And the vast majority of those things were, in fact, pre-cleared. But if the Justice Department saw that what the proposal would have a discriminatory impact on voters, the Justice Department could say, no, you can't do that. And the state or the locality was then free to go into a court in Washington, D.C. and to challenge that. The court said in an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, America has changed, and I wouldn't dispute that. We have certainly made a great amount of progress, but I would dispute what the Chief Justice said. He said America has changed enough such that we don't need to have, in effect, the Voting Rights Act to the same degree that we had before that opinion. I think in a very prescient way, Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, said that, you know, look, if you're in a thunderstorm and you have an umbrella over you and you're not getting wet, that doesn't mean that you take down the umbrella and think that you're going to continue not to get wet. And her, in essence, what she was saying is that the reason that we've made progress and that we have seen the emergence of Black political power and political power of other people of color was because of the existence of the intact 1965 Voting Rights Act, which is the pearl of the civil rights movement. And I think that what she said proved to be exactly right, because almost immediately after the Shelby County case, states started to enact a whole range of unnecessary, inappropriate, and discriminatory measures, designed to keep certain people out of power and to maintain the power of certain other groups of people.
So, of course, one of the ways of influencing the outcome of an election is through gerrymandering, redrawing maps that can favor one party or the other. And you write about how that's done by packing and cracking. Can you explain what those terms mean?
Sure. You know, we have been doing gerrymandering since we have been a republic. The first people to be involved with gerrymandering were James Madison, James Monroe, and Patrick Henry. It's a little interesting story there, but that was among the first gerrymanders. And gerrymandering is just a way in which you draw districts such that you maximize the chances that your party is going to win and that the other party is going to lose. And you can do it in a couple of ways. You can do packing, which is to pack, say, I'm a Democrat. I'm going to pack all of the Republicans into just one district, which when weakens their ability to have an impact on elections in all of the other districts. Or you can crack people. And let's say the Republicans want to look at Democrats and say, we'll put a few Democrats here, a few Democrats there, a few Democrats there. We'll crack them in such a way so that we minimize the power that they have to influence an election. Both parties have done this through the course of our history. Princeton University did a study that said that the gerrymandering that Republicans did in the last cycle, that is in 2011, was the worst of the past half century. And that had an impact over the course of the last decade, where Democrats, for instance, in the first cycle after that redistricting effort, won 1.4 million votes than Republicans, but ended up with a 33-seat minority. They were in the minority by 33 seats, although gaining 1.4 million more votes. And in the last election, again, as a result of that redistricting, Democrats in the House won about 5 million more votes and had a majority of about 5, 6 votes, 7 votes, something along those lines. The real pernicious effect of gerrymandering is that it allows politicians to pick their voters as opposed to citizens choosing who their representatives ought to be. And it results in really things like we're talking about now, where you can have gerrymandered state legislators safe in their districts, only worried about a primary election as opposed to a general election. So that means you cater to your base as opposed to, you know, coming up with solutions that are good for the country as a whole. But you can do things inconsistent with the desires of your constituents. For instance, voting for these draconian, anti-abortion laws, and not face any electoral consequence. And it dissociates, you know, the representatives of in our democracy from the people who they're supposed to serve. It leads to inaction, to gridlock, and ultimately then to cynicism on the part of the American people. So it's gerrymandering is a really, really bad thing, and something that I've tried to combat since I became the head of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee back in 2017.
So as we head into the midterms this year, do you anticipate another shellacking, to use President Obama's word for the Democratic Party?
Well, what I can say about this, kind of tying it back to gerrymandering, the election will not, if there's a shellacking or a big defeat for Democrats, it will not be as a result of the lines that were drawn or the redistricting that was done in 2021 and leading into 2022, it'd be extended into 22 because of the pandemic. The lines are more fair now than they certainly were a decade ago, not as fair as they as I'd like them to be. If they were totally fair, we would have 40% more contested districts than we do around the country. Now, history tells us that in a new presidency, the first time that new president's party goes before the people, they do pretty poorly. That's what happened to President Obama in 2010. The numbers don't look particularly good now for President Biden and for Democrats. But there's still a lot of time between now and November, and we'll see what happens. For instance, what's going to be the impact of this decision that we think we're going to get out of the Supreme Court with regard to overturning Roe versus Wade? Will that be something that will energize the Democratic base? I don't know. We'll see. But if there is a shellacking, it won't be because of gerrymandering.
Yeah. You mentioned President Biden, and, his approval rating has been around like 41%. Of course, we're living in a time where there are a lot of fears about inflation. The stock market has been tanking. We've got the war in Ukraine. COVID remains a threat. Meantime, President Trump is hinting about a 2024 run. There doesn't seem to be, beyond President Biden, a logical Democratic candidate who would just be the person, the person to watch. And I'm wondering if you think that we are ripe for a second Trump presidency, given the state of the way things are right now.
That's a really interesting question. I don't know whether Joe Biden plans on running for a second term. If he does, I guess I would assume that he would be, the nominee. If Donald Trump became the nominee and it became another battle between President Biden and President Trump. I'm not so sure. I think President Biden probably wins that election because President Trump, if nothing else, can turn out Democrats in ways that are truly, truly amazing. Biden won by, almost 7 million votes in the last election, although only, 45,000 votes if you look at the Electoral College in those three or four states. Does the possibility exist that Donald Trump could be the nominee and the next president? I think absolutely. But, it'll depend on who the Democrat is, how things go. Ronald Reagan had a disastrous midterm and then won re-election in a landslide. So you can never tell. And then Donald Trump has, personal problems that he has to deal with. I mean, there are investigations of him in New York, in Georgia. I assume that there's something being done by the United States Department of Justice as well with regard to January the 6th and how all that, what's the impact of all of that? And then the question also is, are Republicans going to be prepared to nominate him in 24? Again, we're talking about November of this year, and I'm saying that's pretty far away. November of 24 is a really long way away, and who knows what will happen over the course of the next, 2.5 years.
How concerned are you about efforts by Republicans to install Trump loyalists in positions that supervise elections that have to do with counting votes and so forth, especially after everything that happened in 2020?
Yeah, that worries me a great deal. I mean, that worries me a really, really great deal. But for the courage, and it's a terrible thing to have to say that they exhibited courage as opposed to simply doing their jobs, but the courage of certain Republican officials who were tasked with the responsibility of administering elections, who volunteered and paid for it, got Vandeveld in Michigan. Secretary Raffensperger in Georgia. And, we heard the tape of Donald Trump trying to convince Raffensperger to find him 11,000 votes, whatever it is. And these folks said no. They said no to that. And if you replace those people committed to simply running elections in a fair way with people who have a partisan slant or who are, you know, believers that this election, the 2020 election, was stolen from Donald Trump, and you put them in decision-making positions. And if the vote is again close, and close in the sense of the how the Electoral College makes elections look in our country, that is a big concern. That is a huge, huge concern. And that's why attention has got to be focused clearly on who's going to run for president. Yeah, I understand talking about that now. But I think between now and then, we need to be focusing a great deal of attention on who serves in as Secretary of State in particular states, who at the very local level are going to be running our elections. We don't want people, frankly, who ignore facts. There was no substantial, you know, fraud in the 2020 presidential election. People who cannot say that and cannot say that Joe Biden is the legitimately elected president. I don't think that you want people like that in charge of the electoral infrastructure. And that is a distinct possibility, because you have people running for Secretary of State in a number of states who are believers in, you know, what I've come to call the big lie. And you see it at the local level as well. So that's something that gives me a great deal of concern.
Yeah. You devote the last part of the book to solutions. In fact, there are several chapters on what we need to do to fix our elections and fix our institutions. One of the institutions is the Supreme Court. And I'd like to just zero in on that one, because you write about how after the Shelby case, your confidence in the high court was shaken. Can you talk about that and about the kinds of reforms that you think are necessary as it relates to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, my confidence in the court was really shaken by Shelby, as I described before, because of all that Congress had done in the reauthorization, the fact that the Republican president had signed the reauthorization, and the court took it upon itself to, in essence, dismantle the act. And I thought that was something that, if not partisan in intent, certainly had an ideological basis to what the court did. And so, you know, it's interesting. I wrote that chapter about the reform of the Supreme Court, you know, this was well before the Roe versus Wade, draft opinion. I said that, you know, what we need to do is have justices serve a period of 18 years instead of serving for life. Chief Justice Roberts has given a speech where he says justices ought to serve 15 years. Mm-hmm. You know, when we started out as a nation, our life expectancy was a lot shorter. Supreme Court justices tended to leave the bench when they died, as opposed to now people serving, you know, 20, 30, some close to 40 years. And they time their departures such that a president who shares their worldview, similar parties, gets to pick who their successors will be. And as a result, the court is seen as a much more political institution than it has been in the past. And so I think limiting them to 18 years, because I think having people serve in a position that powerful, an unelected position, for like 30 years or so is just not good for our democracy. So limit them to 18 years, have them appointed by presidents in a president's first year and in a president's third year of any term, so that new blood is constantly being put in the court. And that depressurize, you know, the confirmation process. You know, if you win, the president wins, he's going to be guaranteed to nominate, at least two people in that first term, two people in a second term. And so I think that's something that we should, that we should do as well. And so I think these are the kinds of things that if we do them, we can restore some lost legitimacy to the court. But I also think we have to respond to what happened to Merrick Garland and to Amy Coney Barrett, where Merrick Garland was denied a hearing or even meetings, didn't get a vote because, according to Mitch McConnell, his nomination came too close in time to the election. And yet, when it came for Amy Coney Barrett, she was confirmed and put on the court while people were actually in the process of voting. And so I think those two seats need to be dealt with, those two seats that, as I describe in the book, were stolen. I think the court has to be expanded to at least to have as a redress to what Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate did with regard to those two seats. So those two seats expand the court, 18-year terms, and then a measured way, a set way in which people are put on the court, I think would make a great deal of sense.
Yeah. Two quick things, General Holder, before we move on to our questions from our audience. One is, you know, for the person who reads your book and feels a sense of alarm about the state of the country, about the efforts to make it more difficult to vote, and all of the things that you and I have just talked about, what can the average person do, having read your book? What can an individual do to try to address this, to try to move the needle in a different direction, if you will?
Yeah, well, you know, I hope that people will have a couple of emotions reading the book. It's a really good book, so buy the book. But I think there's a couple of emotions I hope that they have. First, I want them to feel that sense of alarm. I want people to understand that our democracy is under attack, that, you know, we don't have a democracy that is going to last forever simply because we are the United States of America. It takes work to keep our democracy intact. Now, if you look at the 20th century in Europe, you see the fall of democracies, not because, you know, fascism was strong, but because democracies were not defended in appropriate ways. And so if we don't defend our democracy, I don't say we're going to have, you know, a dictator or anything like that, but we could render our elections almost meaningless and not really have the ability of the people, again, to chart the path of the nation. So I want people to feel alarmed. But I also want people to have a certain sense of confidence that if you look at the first part of the book, where we go through a lot of historical things and talk about, and we share stories about people who were faced with, you know, difficulties in their time, that they came together and overcame. You know, we talked about, you know, Thomas Dorr and making sure that men, white men with property, without property, had the right to vote. Alice Paul, who, you know, fought for women's suffrage. So there are heroes in the past, but there are also present day heroes. We talk about a guy named Chris Hollins, young man in Harris County in Texas. I think he's going to run for mayor of Houston probably next year, who took on a job that nobody wanted, that is to run the elections in Harris County in the middle of a pandemic. That's why nobody wanted the job. And he came up with a whole bunch of innovative ways, you know, to have 24/7 voting opportunities, to have drop boxes, you know, so you didn't have to put yourself at risk getting out of your car to go cast a vote or choose between your job and a vote because you could vote, you know, 7 days in a week, 24 hours a day. And he actually increased to record numbers. Never been more people voting in Harris County for president than in 2020 in the middle of a pandemic. And then just one last one, a young woman named Love Caesar at North Carolina A&T, the largest African-American historically Black college and university in the country, who realized that North Carolina A&T had been gerrymandered, but gerrymandered in a way it was cracked, so that half of the students were in one congressional district, half of the students were in another congressional district, a clear attempt to, you know, dilute the power of that huge number of African-American students. And she took a piece of chalk one night and drew a line right where that district line existed. People got up the next day and said, "What's this chalk line?" And she explained to them, "You're in Congressional District 6, you're in Congressional District 5. We don't vote together for Congress." And through that simple act, that drawing of a line, the advocacy that she brought, the raising of the consciousness of the people at the university and throughout the state, the lines that were drawn by the Republican-led North Carolina legislature were thrown out by the North Carolina courts in a lawsuit that my organization brought. But I have to say that the foundation for that effort was really the actions of that young African-American college student with a piece of chalk. And so that's, as people ask, what is it that I can do? You know, it is to come up with ways in which you get involved in the process and look at what is the situation that you're confronting in your locality, in your city, in your state, and what's the problem? And there are organizations that can use your help. There are a whole variety of ways that we can all be involved in this fight for our democracy, and we have to be involved. And so I hope people feel alarm, a desire for involvement, And at the end of the day, I hope people will feel what I feel, which is optimism, that if we commit ourselves, are prepared to sacrifice and stick it out, we can defend our democracy.
Well, on that note, let's go to some questions from our audience. Susan says, which threat is more serious to the health of our democracy, the recognition and support to establish the United States as a Christian nation, or the government support for a system that prioritizes money and the acquisition of wealth?
Interesting questions. You know, we are a nation that was founded on the notion of religious freedom. And I get a little concerned about the way in which the court has kind of lowered that line, that barrier between state actors, state action, and religion. You know, you have to remember that this country was founded by people, you know, people who came from Europe initially, seeking, you know, religious freedom. And that is something that has been, I think, a real hallmark of our strength. And you look at the how religion has been a divisive factor, you know, around the world when it has been mixed with state policy. So I think that is, in fact, something that we have to worry about. When it comes to economic things, that again is, you know, that's a question of, you know, who you put in power. You know, looking at what a particular person says he or she is going to do if elected, what a particular party is going to do or has done when elected, that's something that where I think, you know, we can glean certain things about certain people, certain parties, and make, you know, and understand what they will do with the power that they get if they are put into office. And so I'm not sure how to answer that question other than to say that both, I think, should be of concern to us. And you know, we shouldn't lose, again, our founding documents were imperfect. You know, we talk about all men are created equal in a nation that enslaved people who looked like me. And yet the ideals that are expressed in those documents are ones that I think we should hold dear. And you know, those first 10 amendments, you know, the Bill of Rights, that really, you know, it's history that we should understand. And it's also history that we should live, use those as guides as we are making policy decisions and, you know, electoral decisions.
Question from Huntley, who says, in the early years of our country, were free men of color allowed to vote as long as they owned property?
That's a very mixed thing. There were certain states in which freed black men had the ability to vote, would not have the ability to vote if they did not own property. That was just a relatively small number of states and a relatively small number of people. Even in the North, you know, the vast majority of states in the North did not allow freed African-Americans to vote. And clearly in the slave states, African-Americans did not have the ability to vote as well. So the number of African-Americans before the end of the Civil War who had the ability to cast ballots was negligible.
Yeah. General Holder, you express in the book frustration, and we touched on this early in our conversation, about the Democrats' inability to get the ball over the line as it relates to voting rights legislation. What's going on there? Why has that not been able to happen thus far?
Well, you know, we had two really good bills that ultimately got put into one. The John Lewis Advancement Act was coupled with the Freedom to Vote Act, and that would have revivified the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and actually, I think, made it better because covered jurisdictions would have been ones all around the country as opposed to just states in the old Confederacy. And you would have gotten covered based on the state's conduct as opposed to the state's history. And so I thought it was a great bill. The Freedom of Vote Act would have done away with partisan gerrymandering, had same day registration, automatic voter registration, a whole range of really good things. But the problem was, and this is one of the reforms we talk about with regard to the Senate, the filibuster. You know, you need 60 votes to get anything through the Senate nowadays, although that wasn't always the case. And we didn't have sufficient numbers of Democratic senators who were willing to change the filibuster to allow votes on those democracy-protecting bills. We only got to 48 senators. You needed at least 50. And then Kamala Harris, as the vice president, could cast a tie-breaking vote. And so Senators Manchin and Sinema did not want to change the filibuster. And so I think their criticisms should be directed at them. But I think we should also not give a pass to those 50 Republicans who decided that they would stand for the filibuster and against progress that was contained in those two bills, that one bill that could have been passed. And I think the Republican opposition was out of concern that if those bills were passed, their view is that more people would vote and that weakens their ability to win, which I don't know if that's true or not. I suspect it's not. I mean, you know, in Virginia, they did away with a lot of the Republican anti-democracy measures when Democrats took over, I guess, about 3-4 years or so ago. And what happened in the last statewide elections, Republicans won everything, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general. You know, their voters turned out. So making things fair doesn't necessarily favor one party or the other, but it does favor the American people. And that's why, it was my hope that those bills would have become law. And I think it's a sad thing that, we did not have the capacity, Democratic Party did not have the capacity to get those bills over the line.
Question from Katie, who says, and this sort of harkens back to some points that you made at the end of our conversation. Katie says, I'm very concerned about election officials who decide elections in swing states being replaced by MAGA sympathizers and a Supreme Court, most notably Clarence Thomas, tainted by right extremism. What can be done to address this by each of us as concerned citizens?
Yeah, well, it requires vigilance and involvement, certainly at the state and local level. You know, actually figure out who is actually running your elections, and people who are, you know, running for offices in order to administer elections. This is something, you know, that we hear this stuff about down ballot races. I hate that term. It's almost as if, you know, only thing that matters is at the top, president, governor, senator. Though, who's running in those so-called down ballot races? I mean, understand who they are. What's their platform? Where do they stand when it comes to, you know, the big lie of, you know, of voter theft in 2020? We have the capacity in most places to pick who administers our elections through the votes that we cast. And so that is a direct control, that we have. With regard to the Supreme Court, as I said, I think as I stand for, you know, the expansion of the court, keeping the number of years that a justice can serve, limiting that as well, that will take time to get the Supreme Court, I think, back to a better place. I think we're going to be stuck with this rather, I wouldn't even say conservative majority, this kind of radical majority for some time. And it's interesting, too, that in terms of that, what I call radical majority, I wouldn't necessarily put Chief Justice Roberts in that, in that fold. I think we're talking about five as opposed to six justices who are a part of the more radical part of the court. And it'll be interesting to see with this decision, the Roe decision, where Chief Justice Roberts ends up, and whether it is a 6-3 decision or, you know, a 5-3-1 decision, that'll be very interesting to see where he comes out. I've a guess that he will not sign on to the majority opinion, but, you know, I could be wrong.
Is there another section of the Voting Rights Act that is also before the court this session?
Yeah, the court is going to hear arguments next year in Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which is really the only part of the act that remains intact. It's really still in its most robust form. It's the part of the act that we used in Alabama when we successfully sued to stop the redistricting that was being done by the state legislature in Alabama that impacted the ability of African Americans in the state, who make up about 27% of the population, and should have, if you just look at the numbers and the way in which people are dispersed, should probably have an opportunity to elect two African Americans to the United States Congress, and they've only had the ability to elect one. We brought the lawsuit in front of a three-judge panel, two of whom were appointed by President Trump, all three of those judges said, you know what, you're right. The lines that are drawn dilute the power of African-Americans in Alabama, and those lines should not stand. The Supreme Court stepped in and said, well, that decision comes too close to the election. I have huge problems with that conclusion, but they said it comes too close to the November election, and therefore we will put this on hold and we'll decide this after we have an opportunity to have arguments next year. And my guess is that you're going to see this Supreme Court with those radical five justices probably do something in a very negative way to Section 2. And if you've done harm to Section 2, Section 4, which is the coverage formula, which has an impact on the Section 5, which is preclearance, you have not reduced the Voting Rights Act to a nullity, but boy, you have taken the real power, the strength, all the positive strength of the act, you've pretty much taken it away.
Yeah. Shifting gears here, a question from Timothy, who says, this is a bit of a softball, but I'm wondering how you got from Columbia University to Attorney General, and thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you told me when I was in college, A, that I'd be a lawyer, B, that I'd be a prosecutor, and C, that I ultimately would be Attorney General of the United States, I would have said, oh, drug test time. I got to college in the 70s. So I had, you know, a big afro and, you know, I wore dashikis and all of this stuff. I had took part in demonstrations. We had non-negotiable demands that we made of, you know, the administration. But I went to law school because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I came out of college with a degree in American history, and I started thinking, well, what do I do with that? And people said, well, you could teach. And I thought, well, I don't want to inflict myself on the future of the nation. And people said, what if you go to law school? There's a lot you can do with a legal degree. And so I thought, all right, I kind of viewed law school as the haven for the undecided. And so I went to law school, but actually then fell in love with criminal law, a great professor, a guy named Telford Taylor, who had been one of the Nuremberg prosecutors. And that really made me think, you know, I think I want to be a lawyer. I think I want to be a litigator. I want to focus on criminal law. And that put me on a path to go to the Justice Department, where I was going to stay for a couple of years and ended up spending 12 years in my first job at DOJ in a thing called a public integrity section, where we prosecuted official corruption cases. And then I became a judge, U.S. attorney, deputy attorney general, and then ultimately attorney general of the United States. So for those of you who are young and still thinking that you know what path you're going to be on in terms of your careers, you only have to think about big afro wearing Eric in college, nobody would have pointed to me and said, this guy is going to be attorney general. And here I am, a lot less hair and a former attorney general.
So Janie says, could you imagine serving on the Supreme Court, and would you want to? And thank you for your work, she says.
You couldn't pay me enough money to serve on the United States Supreme Court. I was a judge for 5 years in Washington, D.C. I was among President Reagan's last nominees to the courts in Washington, D.C. And that shows you how different the time was. You know, I'm a Democrat, and President Ronald Reagan, you know, an iconic Republican president, nominated me to the court. I served for 5 years there, and I didn't like it. As a judge, you're a person who takes in actions that other people have done, and you decide, you know, what's right and what's wrong, if you're doing the job, I think, in the correct way. I was a judge at a time when Washington, D.C. was the murder capital of the country. We had more murders per capita than any other part of the country. I had this ocean of young Black men who should have been the future of Washington, D.C., who I was sending to jail using these mandatory minimum sentences that I had to impose. I just didn't like it. And I remember being interviewed by the Washington Post, and I said that, you know, I feel like a judge, I'm just a referee, and I still want to be a part of the game. I was 37, I guess, when I was appointed to judge. My colleagues on the bench thought that was not, you know, the most not the best way to describe what a judge did as a kind of passive referee, but I wanted to be, I still wanted to be a player. And that's why I when President Clinton was elected, I left the bench and was successful in my attempts to become U.S. attorney. So I set the policies in Washington, D.C. about who got prosecuted, for what, in what court, what sentences would we ask for. And this work that I continued when I became ultimately, attorney general. So that's a long way of saying I didn't like being a judge, and that was a trial judge, being an appellate judge. It's almost a monastic existence. You're just there with your other, on the Supreme Court, your other eight colleagues, a substantial number of whom I'm sure we probably wouldn't get along, but I figure that out, I suppose, out. But no, my answer to that question is no, hell no, I don't want to be on the Supreme Court.
So we're going to take that as a no.
That would be yes. N-O.
Well, Attorney General Eric Holder, it has been such a delight to talk to you, and we just want to thank you for all the work that you have done to preserve and protect our right to vote. The book is Our Unfinished March, The Violent Past and Imperiled Future of the Vote, A History, A Crisis, A Plan. Thank you so much for putting this book into the world, for teaching us about the history of the right to vote in this country, and providing a path to show us what we need to do to hold on to our democracy.
Yeah. Well, thanks for allowing me to be with you. It's an accessible book. It's not some law review article. And let me just end here. Dr. King said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. But here's the deal. It doesn't bend on its own. It only bends when people like us put our hands on that arc and pull it towards justice. And we see that in the book where people did that in the past. And we have specific proposals about how we can do that in the future. But that's what I think we should be about, putting our hands on that arc and pulling it towards justice. We can do it.
And you've given us our marching orders. On that note, I want to thank all of you who have joined us tonight for this discussion, and a special thanks to Catherine Kitty Colbert for opening up the program. And as always, thanks to Andy, Jason, and Laura, our author events team at the Free Library. Thanks, everyone. We hope you have a great weekend. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.